Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, your weekly podcast from the best damned magazine for free minds and free markets you will ever read. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangu Ward. Happy Hanukkah and Advent, brothers and sisters.
Hanukkah, howdy.
Hey, Matt. I'm here burning the Lenten candles for you, in advance.
Happy Cyber Monday.
Oh, oh, you were saving that one.
Wow.
For Cyber Monday, yeah.
You know, I'm thinking right now that Timothy Leary, given his strong Catholicism and whatnot, he should have done a psychedelic Advent calendar.
I'm not sure he didn't. Who knows what went down in Mexico during the
I mean, if you get
the interim period.
The large enough dose, a single dose could be a whole month, right?
So yeah. That's true, yeah. Some people don't come back.
Speaking of some people don't come back, we're going to talk about the Omicron variant here in a moment. But first, do you find yourself even more tired than Ringo Starr at rehearsals when you're trying to keep up with the news? Thwarted by paywalls, misled by clickbait, trapped in a spiral of doom? Well, imagine an app where you can get unlocked access to the most reliable news sites and sats. An app that filters out fake news and trash listicles while showing stories from multiple perspectives in order to counter bias. Where you can find good news and little treasured bits of information unearthed from around the globe. All of this and more is available from an innovative Australian startup called Inkl, I-N-K-L. Inkl.com has signed partnerships with more than 100 news sources, such as The Economist, The Atlantic, and Bloomberg, creating a unique system combining journalists and algorithms to create a best-of newsfeed. You can get more than $12,000 of premium news for just $100 a year. And if you go right now to inkl.com/podcast, they'll give you an additional 25% discount. It's a whole year's worth of headache-free news for just $75. Go to inkl.com/podcast today. You'll be glad you did. All right. So remember the good old days last week, for example, when we weren't panicking. Oh my God, here it comes, Omicron variant. So much for that. Japan, Israel, Morocco, and I'm sure more countries between the time that we're recording and the time when this is released. Not the
Fredonia,
Mulvania. They're all locking down, closing their borders. President Joseph Robinette Biden the 12th has reimposed travel restrictions on 8 African countries who are not so happy about that. Dr. Anthony Science Fauci says it's too early to say whether America is going to get back to lockdowns and mandates, adding, we just really need to, as I've said so often, prepare for the worst. So, Catherine, let's just start there. Is it too early for you to say whether America needs to get back to lockdowns and mandates?
It is not too early. It is, as usual, too late. Now, I mean, I think I was actually thinking about this weekend, that there's sort of these two different universes that we're living in right now. And there's one where people are asking the question, is there a set of restrictions that could be implemented by a highly functional technocracy that could slow or stop the virus in a way that not only makes sense now, but makes sense in the long run in terms of costs and benefits? And then there's another universe where the question is, do we have those institutions or anything that looks even remotely like them? And, you know, I'm living in the second verse in the universe, and the answer is no. We just do not have these institutions. They did not exist at the beginning of COVID. Our trust in the institutions that we did have has eroded since then. And when he says it's too early to say, he means, at least in part, it is too early to say if we have any juice left in any of the players that we should be relying on the government side to help with this. I think the answer is no. And so at this point, my question is, and actually at all points, my question is, what can we do to minimize the damage that these dysfunctional institutions are going to haphazardly do as they half-assedly implement various restrictions that people then work around and also continue to throw up barriers for solutions that people actually want?
But Catherine, quick follow-up, if you will.
Sure.
Doesn't that way lie nihilism on some level? Like,
Man.
We're all, come on, man. We're all just, you know, everything sucks, so we can't do anything, so just don't even try.
I don't even believe in nihilism.
I think that way lies libertarianism,
How long have you been practicing that
line,
Peter? As
you well know, is very different than nihilism. Libertarianism is not nihilism. To say that states are not the right institutions to deal with most of the problems of humanity is not to say there are no solutions. It's to say that implementing solutions top down by force ain't the way, baby. And I think that there are lots of small scale interventions that are working pretty well. And there are lots of commercial interventions that are working pretty well, including it looks like the way that we built some of these vaccines means that we should be able technologically to get out something that can combat new variants quickly. Can we get it out bureaucratically, though? No, we can't.
Let's build on that, Peter, or as the Hungarians say, Peter. Is there any evidence that the FDA has engaged in machine learning during the COVID crisis to
that's not try what to that means.
What, really? To try to figure out how to better.
They are the machine. They're grinding us all down.
Welcome, my son.
I hope they learn.
So, are there lessons, like positive lessons, that either the FDA is learning or should learn in this process now that we're going through, you know, we've had the Alpha, the Delta, and now the Omicron. Is it the Omicron? I forget. Omicron.
Wait, how? Can we get an agreed
upon
pronunciation?
Absolutely not. No, I think it's important to.
Omicron or Omicron?
Turning to Matt Welsh for an agreed upon pronunciation is not the way.
There's some dice.
I want to hear Peter Cullen pronounce this in Optimus Prime voice. You know, like the lead Transformer, right? Because they actually in the 1986 Transformers film, the Transformers fought a planet-sized Transformer robot voiced by Orson Welles called Unicron.
Okay. So I'm glad, well, we have Unicron to look forward to.
Right? Do you want to talk now about public policy, Peter?
Yeah, I mean, I think the FDA has like trained their AI on this, and they've become the FDA on the blockchain, and now we're going to have FDA, and it's going to be Web3.
Stop talking nonsense.
No, they haven't learned anything.
That seems highly leveraged.
They haven't learned anything at all. They obviously haven't learned anything. And what we're the whole lesson of the pandemic is that if the faster you get vaccines that work to people and make them available, the faster your pandemic can be over. And the FDA is like, but that makes us really nervous because that's not a process that we've thought about for about 25 years and determined is the optimal way to save people's lives, even though actually it's very clearly the optimal way to save people's lives. And I will say that at the very, very beginning of the Biden administration, there was like some little thing that they put out in one of their pandemic preparedness releases where they were like, you know, we recognize that this may require some updates to the FDA approval process to move things along faster when there are novel diseases out there that we have to deal with. And so far as I can tell, there has been absolutely no meaningful change to the bureaucracy here, which is a shame because, as Catherine said, the way the mRNA vaccines are designed, it should be possible to produce either new vaccines or boosters really quite quickly, maybe not in a matter of weeks, but in a matter of months, and roll them out to people if you can get through the regulatory process. But right now, we don't have a regulatory process that is comfortable with moving that quickly. It's notable that the vaccine, the first one, the first mRNA vaccine was designed in a weekend in January of 2020. Like before we were talking about a pandemic, before we were talking about COVID, the thing that became the molecule that we put in our bodies that stops this, it already existed. And there was a company that was like ready to deliver it to people. They would have had to go through testing of some sort, in any circumstance. But the reason that it didn't get to us until December of last year was because of the FDA and because of the federally mandated drug approval process.
Nick.
Yeah, and as Ron Bailey told me in an interview, I don't know, some months ago, but that without really doing anything different, the FDA could have easily approved the vaccines by August. so of last year, so that, you know, you're talking about, you know, a significant chunk of time for coming online, which added nothing to the safety process and all. It just added to the body.
Nick, count. I know that you didn't necessarily graduate from the University of Science, but do you have a...
But I worship. I worship at science. I have blind trust in science.
Thank you. What do you think about the sort of immediate response that we're seeing already from the countries that we mentioned, especially Fredonia, but also from the Biden administration on travel bans? Do you have a sense of faith that travel bans are a good way just to sort of like, let's stop this while we can see what's going on as we're trying to figure out what's happening in South Africa?
No, I mean, you know, the lesson that we learned because Donald Trump imposed the last set of travel bans is that travel bans don't work and that they're used for other for political theater and things like that. And so I think that the main message, you know, travel bans aren't going to work. What needs to work is getting people, you know, getting the understanding of what risk is down to the individual and having individuals kind of set their risk tolerance and move forward based on that. Armed with things like vaccines, booster shots, you know, other methods, non-pharmaceutical interventions to reduce risk and, you know, ultimately mortality, which is what we care about. I hope that the takeaway from this moment is, you know, when you see Joe Biden yet again replicating something that the Donald Trump administration did, that Joe Biden himself lambasted him for, that we understand that we are talking about a machine here. It's not. It doesn't matter if it's Joe Biden or if it's Donald Trump in charge of, you know, the White House or in charge of the government. It really has to do with the bureaucracies and with this larger kind of network of, you know, molasses that gets in the way of actually adapting and changing in meaningful real time to new and evolving threats. And I think, you know, that's true across the board on spending. I think it's true on a bunch of other things like immigration policy that Biden is doing, but especially on this, I hope, you know, and it's, you know, it's not like this is the, you know, the upside of COVID or something, but to the extent that this experience and this particular story shifts people from thinking if we only had the right guy at the top of the pyramid, everything would be fine, and rather understanding it's a system that's in place, and it's the system that needs to be dismantled or improved or, you know, just blown up and then restarted. I, you know, that for me, you know, however many extra people die because of FDA and CDC screw-upiness is one thing, but like if we can have an epistemic shift to a systems-based approach to governance rather than an individualistic one, I think that would be a great thing.
Catherine, I recall with, you know, fist clenching kind of anger memory, what happened when Delta came, right? We were just on the verge of kind of finally understanding. And by we, I mean the non-machine learners in governance, especially at school boards in the kind of places that I like to live. We're just finally beginning to realize, oh yeah, this doesn't really get spread by kids and they don't really get hurt that much. So maybe we shouldn't have closed schools for 15 months in a lot of places. And right as that was happening, Delta came and everyone unlearned it all over again and said, oh my God, the kids, we got to do something. And then it turned out that Delta just was more transmissible, but otherwise all the basic characteristics were the same. It's too early to say exactly what's happening with the Africa virus or variants now, but the early preliminary stuff is that it's more transmissible than Delta. It doesn't seem like the underlying characteristics are the same. So my question is, how stabby will your book moms be if the reaction to the Omicron is similar to the reaction to Delta, which is to say, mask all the kids forever and maybe start closing more schools?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, Matt, the woman's weapon is poison. So we're going to be poisony, not stabby. But the the Groundhog Day feeling of COVID on the kind of daily level for those of us who were locked down with our kids early on, I'm now getting the like macro Groundhog Day. Like apparently we're going to have a new variant and everyone's going to go, oh, well, let's We've never dealt with this before. I guess we'll just start from the beginning, and here's what we'll do. First, we'll choose a nation that, you know, just like maybe is where it came, probably is where it came from, this variant, and we'll just block travel from there, but like definitely not for everyone. Like it'll be really, really porous. So it will be easy to defeat the initial travel restrictions. Then we're going to close schools, but we're going to do it in an unpredictable way. Like we're going to just like for some reason have Thanksgiving break be twice as long because screw you, that's why. And then we're going to say like, do the boosters work? We don't know. Maybe we should like confusingly message about that to prevent people who would otherwise have gotten boosters from getting boosters. Like I was privy to a conversation this week where a bunch of well-meaning people were like, I don't know, if there's this new variant, maybe I shouldn't get a booster. I don't know what's going on. And like, then also we should probably just throw in some more masking, like culture war, just for fun. And we're just like, we're going to run out of Greek letters and we're still going to be doing this. It sucks.
So then we'll have to name it after Transformers?
Maybe, or we'll have to go back and double up. No, it'll be like Cyrillic the alphabet variant has like a or thousand whatever. Like, letters, I don't know what we're going to do. Alpha 2 variant. Like, so yeah, I think the extent to which we like reinvent every wheel every freaking time, and that it looks like we're just going to keep doing that, except with the important distinction that in each iteration, our trust in our institutions and our institutions' capacity to change behavior will be diminished. So each time it will be a little bit stupider.
Suderman, tell us about what lessons you think we should have learned from the previous. I don't want to say freakouts because, you know, it's 770,000 people are dead in this country that weren't dead before. But what are some, you know, non-pharmaceutical interventions that maybe got over relied on before that we're going to see or that you worry we're going to see over relying as a response to this?
Yeah. So I've said this before, but I just think it's worth reiterating that the case for mask mandates has just completely disintegrated as far as I'm concerned. And you could make a case for masks as a good tool. And I mean masks and masking, not mask mandates, as a good tool for preventing the spread of the virus in 2020 when there were no vaccines. Masks obviously work in certain settings, right? In surgical settings, you would be really upset if you were wheeled into a surgery theater and you found that no one in the theater, none of the nurses, none of the doctors were wearing masks, because we understand that masking is actually valuable in certain circumstances. It can prevent transmission of diseases and stuff like that. So you can see how there could be a case for masking. But what it turns out is that mask mandates actually incentivize the lowest quality masking, right? So both low quality masks and low quality wearing of those masks, right? And so when you see people walking around in cloth masks, there's very little evidence that the basic cloth masks that you get on Etsy, the ones that are more comfortable, that people like, and you know maybe even look a little better, that they do anything at all except cover your mouth in a nice looking piece of fabric. That's it. They don't seem to do very much beyond that. And a lot of people don't wear them right. They're not wearing them in a very, you know, tightly fitted. They're not necessarily wearing them over their nose because it's a mandate. And what do you do when you have a mandate? You do the absolute minimum to comply with it. This is a thing that we know about human behavior. This is a thing that every single person who has ever been in a managerial role in anything has found out that if there is a requirement.
It's open enrollment season, people.
Yep. Oh, if God. There is a requirement. People will do the absolute minimum, and the absolute minimum here shows that you are wearing a mask and doesn't do anything else. And so what the mask mandates end up being is a demand for signaling. Because the one thing that mask mandates do is they show you who is the person who is masking, who is, right, they're demand, wait, what, I should say, the one thing that masks do is they show other people that you think that this is serious. And so that is why so much of the commentary and punditry around masking talks about you got to make sure to wear your mask as politeness to other people. No, it's not. It's okay. It's politeness. And you can maybe frame it that way. But I think it's much more about showing other people and then being able to identify other people. Oh, that you take this seriously. in fact, it doesn't show that you take it seriously, because it doesn't, in most cases, do much. Now, N95s are a little bit different. Surgical masks do have some more protection, do offer some more protection than cloth masks.
What about diving suits?
But in most cases, what mask mandates do is just incentivize minimal compliance that has no or exceptionally little beneficial health effect.
Nick, I want to pick up on something that you mentioned before we started taping.
You know, that seems like so long ago, Matt. COVID has really changed the way we think about time.
Which is the negative effects of anticipatory dread, which is kind of an...
anticipatory anxiety.
David Leonhardt, who is the in-house rationalist at the New York Times, in his newsletter this morning,
he's the shadow CDC director.
Yeah, I mean, he like makes it okay for neurotic, high income lefties to not be completely irrational. He says, assuming the worst about each worrisome new variant is not a science-based rational response, and alarmism has its own costs, especially to mental health. What do you think about that, Nick, about the mental health of anticipatory anxiety?
Yeah, I mean, it's important to think about that, because a lot of what we're doing has been revealed, or a lot of what we did was revealed along the lines of what Peter was talking about, was kind of superstitious behavior. B.F. Skinner, when he was training pigeons to play ping pong and take the SATs and stuff like that, he found that pigeons would mimic, they would replicate the behavior they did whenever a pellet was dropped on, you know, on them for food, regardless of whether it had anything to do with causal relationships, in the world. And we've done a lot of that kind of stuff. That's, you know, pretty much the last 2 years has been a junkyard of us, you know, just mixing correlation with causation, or just doing this kind of virtue signaling in a biomedical space. So I think there's a lot of truth to that. And, you know, to also build on what Catherine was saying, the continuing decline in trust and confidence in all of our institutions, you know, government first and foremost, but then also the media, which has been terrible on this, as well as charitable organizations and whatnot, it's not a death spiral, but it's a widening gyre for Yates fans. That's leading to
also
anarchy,
the name of
because
a
you
Batman
cannot trust
miniseries
anything
written by
getting.
Kevin Smith, I believe.
I hate you.
I think that's where Yates got it from, actually. Pretty sure. But it has to stop at some point, and really, I don't know what it is, because it's like I think if we focus more on the system and what's wrong with the system, that might be a beginning of a kind of awakening. But I mean, I'm really thinking in terms of Sartre's version of The Flies, the old play where a town is, an ancient Greek town is occupied by a plague of flies everywhere. And ultimately the hero just kind of throws it off. He has an existential realization of action and autonomy. That's kind of what we need here, because we're not going to get it from the CDC. We're not going to get it from the FDA. We need to figure out as a society and as individuals how to move on from this, take care of ourselves the best we can, and then get on with
it. I also want to say, like, this phrase that we use all the time, and I think it's a really important one, about declining trust. Like, I keep trying to think of a different phrase for it, because that phrase implies that, like, something happened in the population. Like, the people are not trusting sufficiently in the institutions. But that's like, you know, it's like, well, if I repeatedly make lunch plans with a friend and they don't show up, or like show up 5 hours late, I have declining trust in that friend. But it's not like a flaw in me. It's that my trust was abused. Like, my trust has been abused by the state in so many ways, in basically every way, which is why I'm a libertarian, but especially with respect to COVID. And some of it, I think, like, my trust in government institutions actually did not immediately decline at the very beginning of COVID, because it struck me as like, oh no, this is a hard new thing and our institutions aren't built to deal with it. But we are now so far in. We are many, many Groundhog Day iterations in, and our institutions have aggressively chosen not to adapt. And at that point, of course, you're going to have a decline in trust. But again, like I keep trying to think about, like, it's government failure. It's not a failure on the part of the population.
All right. Well, trust is currency, and it can inflate and deflate.
Oh, damn. Look at that inflation segue.
Nope. Not going to go there. We're going to go actually to a bit early to our email of the week here in a moment. But first, are you being held back by depression, stress, anxiety, insomnia, and similar problems? You can do something about that today. Visit betterhelp.com/roundtable to receive instant confidential access to a network of licensed mental health professionals in all 50 states, possibly even the District of Columbia. BetterHelp.com, that's H-E-L-P, like what the Beatles needed to make any decisions at all in January 1969, has helped more than 1 million people take control of their own mental health. Listeners to the Roundtable get a special deal, 10% off your first month. Other financial aid is available, even though BetterHelp.com is affordable to begin with. Go to the website, BetterHelp.com/Roundtable. Describe your issues and your preferred technological methods of delivery, and they'll get you someone to talk to within 24 hours. If you don't like that person, you can swap him or her out immediately. Please visit BetterHelp.com today. You'll be glad you did. All right, keep sending your great and to-the-point questions via email delivery at roundtable@reason.com. Also, send us questions right the hell now for our special annual videotaped webathon extra bonus podcast thingy, which we are going to be taping on Wednesday. We're going to talk more about that and the webathon aspects in a bit. But first, here is a lot of, but first, here's this week's email from Bob, California. Bob writes, starting this fall, students across the 23-campus California State University system are being required to take an ethnic studies course in order to graduate. It's a result of AB 1460, it's the name of a law, people, which Gavin Newsom signed into law in August 2020. Students have a range of choices covering the historically disadvantaged points on the ethno-racial pentagon. It's a really, really great phrase. However, all of these courses hew closely to a single state-defined model. So, what's your take, O Roundtable, on a requirement that all graduates of a public university system take a specific course? Does your opinion depend on the content of the course, say, an English composition course as opposed to a social justice course? And if so, where do you draw the line? Says Bob in California. Catherine, did they make you take such ethnic studies pentagram courses on the yacht there?
No. At Yale, they had a distribution requirement. So you kind of had to like dabble in the various disciplines. And then they were like, OK, good enough. Of course, this resulted in lots of humanities people taking deeply, deeply ridiculous math and science courses like Physics for Poets and Rocks for Jocks and the like as a way of getting that credit. I built a telescope early every Friday morning for an entire semester as a way of getting a science credit, which is both awesome and was not probably the thing that the authors of this distribution requirement had in mind. I think they were trying to help me get a liberal arts education, but I was like, no, what if I build a telescope really hungover every week? That's what I'm going to do instead. And that I actually think
that seems like a liberal arts education to me.
In a way, it was. In a way, it was. But I actually think that gets to what Peter was saying earlier, and also to this email, which is that mandates make people's behavior stupider, and this mandate will make people's behavior stupider. There will be both a bunch of dumb ways to comply with this mandate, like, you know, I guess there will be these different ethnic studies courses or whatever, but I'm guessing that they will like proliferate or somehow differentiate. People will figure out how to take the one you don't actually have to go to or whatever it is. And or they will find other dodges. I mean, I think like, you know, colleges are allowed to have distribution requirements, even public colleges. This is, of course, why public everything shouldn't exist. I mean, I don't mean to be that guy, but I really, really, really am that guy. If you don't want to have a fight about what should be in a college education, I should not be paying for your college education. Like, that's it. that solves this problem. And no one's up for that solution, but that is the solution.
But my roads.
I don't know. I don't think that you know, the public-private thing would end the controversy over this. Back in the 90s when Stanford changed its Western civilization requirement, which was a mandatory class that all students had to take, to something more politically correct, that started a huge national argument about things like that. It actually helped launch Peter Thiel, who was at Stanford at the time and wrote a lot about it. Distribution requirements, as the letter writer points out, that's, you know, that's part of parcel of what it means to go to college. And I think colleges are right to have distribution requirements because students don't really know very much. And if you're coming out of a school with a particular degree, you know, it's supposed to reflect the values of those institutions. I find ethnic studies classes almost always to be hypercharged politically and ideologically. And I'm sure most of these classes will be among the worst of those types of things. But actually, I like the broader concept. I think students should be told with a fair amount of energy, this is what you should know by the time you come out of here in these different areas.
Do you think, Nick, though, that like, this is what you should know is a reasonable thing for colleges to say? This is what everyone who goes through the California public university system should know seems like a little bit of a different proposition, right? Like, we've talked, and I think you and I disagree, about the broader kind of civilizational or public utility of universal or semi-universal liberal arts education. But this is yet another degree removed from that, right? Like, this is not necessarily kind of the core of somehow defending or enlivening liberal values. It's just put everybody in the same size box in the service of educating people about how all our boxes are actually different shapes and sizes or something.
I'll tell you, I mean, as somebody who taught at the college level expository writing freshman comp, which I myself didn't have to go through because I was a genius enough to place out of it by AP test.
Yeah, that's the yacht of Rutgers right there.
Every college has some kind of freshman writing class, which ultimately and always is an ideological cesspool. You know, I'm not in favor of those courses. I think departments should teach the type of writing they want for their majors or minors or whatever like that. But having said that, I think a history requirement, I think something like an ethnic studies requirement. I'm not against the concept of required classes and even ones that are ultimately kind of political or ideological in nature. I think from the point of view of what the people pushing this think it's going to accomplish, that's where they're going to be really, really sorely disappointed because, and I say this again as somebody who taught composition, you do not make adherence to your ideology when you force college students to take your course no matter what. It's a bad way to do it. If you want to actually increase an appreciation for and an understanding of different kinds of racial, ethnic, cultural backgrounds. This is a really shitty
Peter, what was your favorite required course at Florida Man University?
In this essay, I will argue against general education requirements at public universities for these three reasons. I have very mixed
Since
feelings
the beginning
about all this,
of
right?
time.
I have very mixed feelings about all of this.
Yes.
Because
the classic writer William Shakespeare.
Yeah, I don't feel like I was well served, or like many of the people I knew were well served by general education requirements. The people who I was close with were all pretty intensely focused on doing specific things, and they were good at those things and interested in those things and totally uninterested in the other things. And so I, for example, was just not very interested in my chemistry classes. And when I eventually, the school that I ended up graduating from, a public university in Florida, had a requirement that in order to graduate with a four-year degree, you had to have a foreign language. But you could get out of that if you took a cultural understanding course. So I took the politics of Britain and the UK, which was great. I had this like snarky Brit as my teacher. He was as my instructor. He was relatively young. And he told us stuff about how the British government was kind of ridiculous. And then he spent half of the semester, every other class, we just watched episodes of Yes Minister. And it was wonderful because I learned about the British government, and I didn't have to learn how to speak a foreign language.
It's a happy story of a required class. I mean, I'm sure at some of these schools they'll be showing Chico and the Man reruns or something like that.
When the folks
people will learn something valuable.
I wish that
it was exactly the opposite of the intent of the people who said that everybody who graduates from
a Florida four-year university
should learn how to speak a foreign language.
Yeah.
Should English majors be forced to, and this is, you know, like, should English majors be forced to take, Shakespeare or Milton classes, or have a distribution of courses? This is typical in English departments of you got to take so many courses before 1800, British versus American versus the Anglosphere. I can't get that hopped up over this. I think the better focus is that, like, to the people who are proposing these classes, it is going to backfire in ways that are totally predictable and that will not get you more bodies for the next demonstration about how racist and sexist and irredeemable America is.
I have a studied disinterest in all things having to do with universities, pointless anecdotes. One is that I took, not as a requirement, but as an enthusiastic elective at the University of California at Santa Barbara, a Chicano studies class taught at the time, because I'm very interested in the history of the Southwest and especially the Mexican influence on California. It was the single worst class I've ever taken on any level in the history of mankind.
How many college classes did you take, though, Matt Walsh?
20, I don't know, something like
not
that.
Not enough.
It depends.
What was so bad about it?
The reading was uninteresting. The presentation from the professor was very kind of hectoring, and it was a sour presentation. And all of the potential kind of interesting things in literature and activism or history just were not there. And that was a crushing disappointment. The other anecdote I will share is that in 1990, things were happening maybe up at Stanford on our campus, there was a hunger strike for the creation of an ethnic and gender studies requirement that I covered for the college newspaper, and it was like the biggest single like campus deal there for 5 years, basically since the after the anti-apartheid protests from 5 years previously. A huge deal, and eventually they got their way. My contribution to it was by pointing out that of the activists, sort of like a little bullet point history of the 12 things that led us to this point, 11 of them were outright fabrications, for which they never forgave me. They thought I was against them, and maybe I was. All right, so let's move on now to the aforementioned webathon. So here's the thing. Beginning at Tuesday at 8 a.m. sharp, and we're recording this on Monday morning. This will be posted, as per usual, early Monday afternoon. But beginning on Giving Tuesday, Reason does its annual week-long online-only fundraising drive where we make the case for you, especially those of you who are happily consuming all of our freely available product, for instance, this year podcast. We're trying to convince you to give us a tax-deductible gift at the end of the year, small, gigantic, what have you, to the 501c four that publishes our act. What are we, Catherine?
Three.
I got confused.
Yeah, Matt, stroke come
there.
On.
A little bit.
Maybe you should have taken the mandatory math class.
That's probably true.
Educational.
Let us talk a little bit about the reasons for the season, Catherine. Set up our webathon. This isn't the webathon that we're talking about. I mean, we're talking about the webathon. The webathon happens tomorrow, but we want to give you, the listener, a kind of special little goose. So, Catherine, tease the webathon for us, would you?
Yeah. I mean, you know, Reason is mostly made up of people. The vast majority of our money we spend on the humans that make the content that you like. And we give everything away. We give away everything we make. Like, you can buy a paper magazine for money, but we will even eventually give you all the content in that paper magazine for free. We give you these here podcasts for free. We give you just like really, really good videos for free. We not only give the stuff to you for free, we helpfully deliver it to your social medias so you can get it all kinds of good places. And that just takes humans to do. It takes humans to do the investigations. It takes humans to do like 1,000 FOIA requests that never get answered. It takes humans to make the phone calls. And so your money pays for those humans to do the stuff they're good at. And like we need to, I think in past years in the Webathon, I've even done staffer specific requests that were like, please buy Ron Bailey a hovercraft. And I do stand by that request. Ron really needs a hovercraft because he's sad. Ron Bailey is sad about how things are going.
Can we
I want to get him on one of those flying motorcycles.
I want to like I would donate more if we can get Robbie off of scooters.
No, scooters are great. As I said last week, scooters are awesome. Yeah, Robbie needs to pay for his scooter rides. Suderman needs cocktail ingredients. Like we gotta.
Isn't this what sex work is for?
You know. So this is the thing, though, right? Like, there is this, like, substackification and only fansification of the internet, and I do not begrudge a single creator their hard-earned $5 a month payment or whatever it is. I don't know how much the OnlyFans has cost, I swear. But, you know, at Reason, our model is different. We have an older model, and it, I think, really works, but it does require you, instead of setting up your $5 or $10 or whatever a month it is payment at Patreon or Substack or OnlyFans, it requires you to make a donation kind of as an active choice. And I like that. I think it means, you know, it's people who are being thoughtful about consuming our content and then wanting to throw us some cash. And this is the moment to do that.
Speaking of older models, Nick, it's Susie Chafee's birthday today.
Oh my God! Yeah. I like to think of her as Susie Chapstick.
That's all we think about is Susie Chapstick.
That's what I call her at her request.
Nick, you have helped tee up some extra special sauce on this year's Big Mac of a Reason Webathon. Do you want to describe the secret ingredient?
Sure. We are releasing our first ever, or we are not releasing, but a trustee of ours, Ted Barnett, who has a history in the tech sector and whatnot, is auctioning off an NFT of the Reason Roundtable at OpenSeas, which is the largest NFT auction site. And if you go to OpenSeas, this will OpenSea, it will also be on the Reason website later today or very early tomorrow. But if you type in Reason auction, Reason NFT auction at OpenSea.io, you will be taken to a wonderfully nifty image of the roundtable of Catherine, Peter, Matt, and myself in kind of pixelated NFT-friendly format. So that's exciting. NFTs will have an explainer up about them as well, non-fungible tokens. It's a type of kind of blockchain or distributed art that is kind of sweeping the globe, and it's a lot of fun.
And Peter, we decided to nix the you get to spend extra money to come inside Peter's house with the very large and large the
you
two
can,
dogs.
Spend if you give, I think it's $1,000. You can get a lunch with a Reason editor here in DC, and you should obviously have lunch with me because I am the most fun, and I will take you to a good lunch. But I guess
are we going to be bidding up? Like, no, I will take you to lunch, and I'll let you get the guacamole on the side.
That's an interesting question.
You get a milkshake. I'll stake you to a milkshake.
Yeah, I mean, you know, markets and everything, Nick.
Yeah,
if we go to lunch, we'll definitely talk cocktails.
And maybe drink one, depending.
There you go.
On what kind of lunch it is.
I encourage everybody to go to the Webathon page on the site, which would be reason.com/donate, of all things, and check it out. See about giving levels. And here's my last sort of a little plea is that I think on the form traditionally we've had a little bit of thing like feedback, like hey, you know, here's tell us something, what you like, what you don't like, what you want, whatever. If you're coming specifically for the roundtable, let us know. Or if you really, really love, you know, Robbie's scooter content, let us know. We're very interested, especially in the moment when people are giving us money to explain what the impetus is, what you like, or just, you know, suggestions or really, really good limericks. We're always in favor of that. Nick studied limericks at the University of Science, little known fact. All right. Peter mentioned earlier, pointed out that it is indeed Cyber Monday. And we could talk forever about that, man, but we don't necessarily have the time for it. Just a little tiny little snippet of thought that I had, and maybe I'll get Peter to comment first on it, is that Cyber Monday was started in like 2004 or five, right around then. And when like we're trying to encourage people to think about buying online, and man, the internet was a little bit more optimistic back then than it is now. There's like, you know, it was all about techno optimism in the future and getting rid of gatekeepers. And now, at least in the way that we talk about it publicly, there seems to have been a souring, even if the behavior of people is more cyber-tastic than ever before. So, Peter, do you want to wax poetical about that for a couple of seconds?
Yeah, so I'm still optimistic about the internet, like really optimistic about it all the time, every day, because the internet in 2021 is a vehicle for abundance, and it is a vehicle for abundance that we take for granted. Even in the last 2 years, when it has become more evident than ever that the internet is the thing that is supplying us with all the stuff that we need, and even more, all the stuff that we want, not just the stuff that we desperately need, but the things that bring us joy, that bring us interest in life, like, for example, the Reason Roundtable podcast, like a lot of great content every single day at Reason.com. But also, I think at least twice a week, about the absolute miracle of music streaming services. Because I am an idiot who subscribes to several of them. Like, I have Tidal. Yes, I am that guy. And I just think about what it was like when I was growing up as a music fan, like a pretty hardcore music fan who spent a huge amount of time thinking about collecting, listening to, trying to learn how to play, recording my own music, and how incredibly difficult it was to obtain new stuff. I mean, literally, there were like shadow networks of indie bands that would sort of, they'd travel, you know, they'd do a regional tour, and they would bring with them tapes, and you would then tape their things, or maybe make, you know, by 2000 you were making CDs of your own. But it was just this actual sort of underground distributed physical ad hoc network where people actually had to meet and trade physical stuff in order to find out about new music. And you might read about something in a zine. Do you guys remember what zines were? They were great. Let's not go there. Zines were wonderful. Some of my first writing was published in a music zine. You would find out about music, and you would read about it, and it would be months sometimes before you could obtain a copy of the tape or the CD that you had heard about, because there was limited supply and it was difficult to get things from place to place. And now for $10 or $15 a month, you can have access to nearly any recording ever via Spotify or Apple Music or any of these other services. And it's just a kind of, it is, like I said, it is a kind of abundance that we now just take completely for granted and assume as part of our ordinary lives. And there's so much of that right now. I mean, Amazon slowed down a little bit during the pandemic, but also did a pretty good job considering that there was a demand change that was just incredible. And they're building out supply. They're building out their ability to move goods around and to get stuff to you in a day or two. Here they've hired hundreds of thousands of people and are building physical facilities. And so this is the way. This is a way that the internet has combined with physical developments, with property, right, to get us stuff that we want, stuff that we need. You know, Catherine talked about a couple of weeks ago about how the internet is a way to get your dog food easily. It's actually kind of difficult to get gigantic bags of dog food into your house if you have a couple of gigantic dogs. Except now it's not, because a guy just comes and delivers them to you on exactly the day that you need them, 2 days before you run out of dog food. And that's the internet in 2021. And it's actually kind of wonderful. And if you described that to someone in 1993 and just said, you'll never have to worry about running to Walmart or Petco again because somebody will just know when you need dog food. And also, every album ever will be available just by saying in your kitchen, hey, Alexa, play that. Like, people in 1993 would have been like, what? That's crazy. That's not going to happen. I don't believe that. But here we are, and it's happening. And that sort of thing is going to keep happening, and it's going to keep being wonderful.
I think Peter's exuberance, which I share for the contemporary internet, is really important to keep front and center, because there was a moment in the early 2000s after the tech bubble where a lot of the wise people in the world were, you know, sour on the internet, that it was a big scam, that it was destroying civil society, it was awful, it was, you know, wrecking the world and all of that kind of stuff. That kind of dark vision of the internet is back, and it's much more powerful now because you have among many of the major players in tech calling for, you know, they acknowledge that, yes, I'm making people feel bad about themselves. I'm creating FOMO, and that's a terrible thing. I'm ready to be regulated. This is an important moment for the internet. The internet is what saved us during COVID, both by sharing information as well as, more importantly, goods and services. But there's a real push against it. And I think it's worth keeping in mind what Peter, you know, we take for granted the amazing bounty, the superabundance that is everywhere around us. And we're going to miss it if it's gone. And a lot of people are trying to choke it.
Just fact check, Peter, you cannot get freely at your fingertips the classic 1994 album, Matt Welch and the Froggy Pete. So not exactly true.
That is why the internet is good, Matt.
You could solve this problem, I bet, for the internet, Matt.
Yeah. Do you know who you're talking to? Do you really, like, really solve it? Let's go to our
Also cannot get my solo releases from 1998 and 1999 under the moniker The Mule, a reference to Isaac Asimov's Foundation series.
All of this is bad. I will say, like, you know, Peter was talking about the kind of superabundance thing, which I think is huge. The other thing that's good about it on the internet is that it's not something that someone gives to you, right? It's something people make together and do together. To the extent that there is a giver of this abundance on the internet, this is why people are so hype about Web3, right? Like, this is what Web3 is supposed to solve, is it is supposed to make there not be a one giver, to sort of remove the bottlenecks, right? The early internet was sort of hobbyist and institutional. Web 2.0, which is what we have roughly now, is sort of commercial, but it has these choke points, which are the big platforms. And so it has started to feel to many people like there is a king who's benevolently giving us the beauties of the internet rather than people making that stuff together. In theory, what Web 3 does is you know, further move us into the realm of just individuals collaborating and away from abundance that is given, but instead abundance that is made. And I think if any of that turns out to be real, that's going to be pretty baller.
Right. The other day on this podcast,
it's a million Mogadishus.
But the other day on this podcast, I said I was super excited about the blockchain as a system for creating trust between individuals who don't know each other. And that is what Web3 is.
Lightning round, end of podcast, can't last more than 7 minutes. What we have been consuming. Catherine, do you want to lead us off by example?
I would love to. I just watched the second season of the Netflix series Love, Death, and Robots. Yes, I am a cliche, but I enjoyed it a lot. It came out, I think, last spring, so I'm late to it. It's cool because it's a bunch of little episodes and they are, each one is creatively different. I would say that the best one was the episode called Automated Customer Service, which is about an armed sentient Roomba. And if that doesn't appeal to you, there's no hope for you, but it appealed to me.
Nick, what have you been consuming?
I consumed a ton of stuff this past week as my son Neil and I scoured New York for experiences, and I might get to some of those later. But the thing I want to talk about right now is the Lehman Trilogy, which is a play that is about Lehman Brothers and the original Lehman Brothers, who were German-born Jews who came to Alabama, of all places, in 1844 and created a cotton market, a marketplace for cotton selling, eventually moved to New York and became the famous investment firm that ultimately, you know, helped precede the economic crisis, although no members of the Lehman family were still involved in its operation by then. The Lehman Trilogy is a fantastic three-person play with incredible staging and incredible acting, but it's a meditation on slavery, on capitalism, on immigration, on Jewishness, on being an outsider, becoming an insider. It's a phenomenally rich, at times dark, mostly comic vision of American life of the past, you know, 150, 200 years. The Lehman Trilogy is really great, and I only hope that it gets taken from the stage. It was a big hit in London. It's, you know, it's on Broadway now, and it'll tour the country eventually. But I hope that some wider form of it gets represented, because it's a great text to kind of think about who we were as Americans, who we are, and who we can be.
Terrific. Peter, what have you been consuming?
I have been watching the Wheel of Time TV series on Amazon Prime Video. It is based on Robert Jordan's incredibly long fantasy series of the same name. I have never read the books, but I have to say I found the first couple episodes of the TV show to be pretty disappointing, with weak performances, overly expository dialogue, a lore-heavy script that sort of doesn't bring you in. It just tells you what's going on. And like I said, it's a disappointment in part because the material is supposedly pretty great. And also there was a ton of resources. Amazon is spending a bunch of money on this show. And I think it just shows how hard it is to create a Game of Thrones-like epic that really brings you in from the beginning and actually grabs your attention, even if you have a gigantic budget and you know the time and money to spend on something like this.
I watched, as did a few people in this country, apparently, the Peter Jackson's Get Back documentary, the three-part, about eight-hour series that came about because the Beatles had, the Beatles were a rock band from Liverpool. They had a movie called Let It Be that was based on filming their rehearsals for and brief rooftop concert, their last ever concert the album of the same name, Let It Be. And the movie, which came out in 1970, was kind of grimy to look at. The colors were washed out. They had some difficulties transferring the 16 millimeter to the 35 millimeter. And it came out right as the Beatles had broken up. And so everyone was viewing it through through the lens of this, you know, traumatic breakup, and the movie's been kind of shelved. They haven't put it on the streaming devices despite Peter Sudeman's best attempts. So they gave Peter Jackson access to 60 hours of filming and 150 hours of audio, including like hiding microphones in the lunchroom as John and Paul are talking about what to do. And it's this, the framing of it is about basically a calendar month. They have to start from scratch with not really many or any songs, trying to figure out how to write and rehearse and arrange those songs, figuring out, should we stage it live in Libya? What is the documentary going to be about? They're squabbling. It's pretty clear that John in particular is on all kinds of heroin. It's a story of a marriage kind of breaking apart in terms of the Beatles' marriage, while Yoko Ono is perched next to John or attached next to him at all times. But what it ends up being, that's the sort of the structural device of it. It ends up being this really marvelous and moving vision of something that we couldn't see before exactly, which is how did this band, which is a very good band from Liverpool, you should check them out, called the Beatles, how they actually created stuff, even as they were completely at their exhausted wits' end. George Harrison, Nick's favorite Beatle, quits, you know, halfway or at the end of the first episode of the three.
Pete was best. Please.
No, Stu Sutcliffe, man, of now and forever. Yeah. And it shows all this rehearsal and then forming songs together. There's a miraculous thing that you could see on Twitter where incredibly hungover Ringo and George Harrison are sort of sitting wobbly on the drum riser while Paul is kind of thumping on his bass. And you watch in about 2.5 minutes time forming out of nowhere, basically the structure, the verse, the chorus, and the lines for Get Back. And it just sort of like, it happens, the song Get Back. It happens all at once watching that. That is marvelous. It's very moving. You don't have to be a Beatles fan or a fanatic. Anyone I know who's ever been in a band, so Suderman with his mud crutch that he was in there in Florida, it brings so much, and it's just amazing to see even, you know, not their best album by any stretch of the imagination, and at the, you know, they're right about ready to collapse and fall apart, that they still have this really alchemical and amazing to watch kind of process. I can't recommend it high enough. And Peter Jackson restored lovingly, as he's learned how to do, the film. So it's very bright and colorful and very 1969. It's terrific. It's moving. Check it out. And that's all the time that we have. To check anything out here on the Reason Roundtable podcast, go to reason.com/podcasts for all of our offerings, including the fantabulous Reason interview with Nick Gillespie and the Soho Forum debates. And again, you guys can be the first ones to go to reason.com donate, because the webathon starts on Tuesday, but we're telling you about it now. So if you want to go there right now, I'm not going to stop you. Reason.com donate. Check it out. And we're going to have the extra special, again, webathon bonus video episode. Send us those emails at roundtable@reason.com. Okay. Thank you. Goodbye.